check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.
Hello, everyone, and welcome in to Debate Night. I'm Hunter, joined as always by Brody and Silas. And a quick note before we get into today's episode, today's episode is not going to be monetized. So if you're listening, you're not going to hear any ads. And if you're watching here on YouTube, you're not going to see any ads before the show, during the show, or after the show. This will be not monetized at all. But with that being said, let's actually toss it over to Brody, who just wanted to go ahead, clear the air, go on record, and get this Twitter beef over with, if you will.
Yeah, crazy last week. You know, and I think obviously we needed to address it, and a lot of that obviously goes on me. I know initially when this all went down, we had discussed, and we'll go into this here a little bit, we had discussed trying to make it as smooth and as clean as possible. And I probably dropped the ball on that. And, you know, we've talked off air about me kind of messing up. And so, and I've, you know, obviously I've apologized on some of my social media accounts already about it, kind of getting sucked into the drama aspect of it. And, you know, for the listeners watching now, I just want to apologize as well, because I do think some of my actions haven't been good. And that's not really how I want to act online. And that's not really how I want to just be as a person. I think some of the stuff I did was kind of petty and stuff like that. And I think a lot of it stemmed from me not really being able to come out and like tell my side of the story, and having a lot of people generate their own idea of what happened. And instead of me just being okay with what happened and moving forward, I kind of stirred the pot in like kind of pointing people in certain directions. And I think that ultimately kind of made it worse, to where now we do have to address it, because it has come to the point of where, you know, I think before there was maybe a handful of people. It was no shocker if you watched live, or if you watched coverage of when me and Paul were on Lead Card or Chase Card or whatever it was, there was no interaction there. So it doesn't really take a rocket scientist to see like, oh, something has to be going on, because these two guys were friends. They were in a lot of videos together. And now they don't speak to one another. So I do want to apologize for that. I do want to get clear also on a couple things. I think some people are confused. By no way do I think I have a better disc golf career than Paul. By no way do I think that I'm a better disc golfer than Paul. I think those two things are very clear. I'll be the first one to tell you where my standings are on the Pro Tour. I do think I still have obviously a lot to give. I still think I can hopefully at one point get to a level to where I can compete maybe at that level week in, week out. But as of right now, it's clear. Look at the standings. It doesn't take more than 5 seconds to see that there's a clear gap there. So I think a lot of people kind of got upset with some of my comments in regards to like a rivalry and all this stuff. My point there was just trying to say like, we don't always have to be friends with everyone on tour. Not everyone has to get along. Now, how they handle that off the course, I think is one thing. And I think I did handle that poorly. And that's something that I'm going to try to work on, of trying to keep my head down, like I said, and focus on myself, focus on foundation, and move forward. Try not to get caught up into the drama as much as I did. So that is kind of where we're at on that. This all spurred, if you haven't seen it yet, this all spurred from essentially the Nico situation, which is kind of crazy how that was like the talk of the town, right? Everyone was talking about Nico, and Paul came out with, I think it was 2 Instagram stories that were basically just text. And if you haven't seen those, they're probably somewhere on the internet that you can pull up. But essentially, I saw that from, I think, my Facebook collector group. It got posted somewhere on Facebook to where I saw it. And it's like a weird thing of like, this is where it's tough, because I was trying, I think I did an okay job of getting my opinion on the issue out there and because Paul has probably the biggest voice in disc golf. I think we can all agree to that, of where if Paul says something, I think you see a lot of fans agree with it. And then I think you also just have a lot of players that necessarily might not want to disagree with Paul, right? Because that can be kind of devastating a little bit. And you can go to my, you can go to the collector page. I don't know if you guys have checked that out, but like there has been a big increase on the collector page of people that are heavily disagreeing with me. And I'm completely fine with that. Obviously, I don't want certain areas to just be yes men, of where everything I say, everyone's just like, yes, yes, 100%. And this was a situation too, where I think Hunter, you know, offline, we've talked about it. People on social media have shown me how I didn't handle the situation well, because I could have kept my point of saying, hey, I don't know if attacking the official is the best thing to do. And we can get a little bit into the whole Nico situation, what we feel about the suspension, what we feel is right. Is it too much? We can get into that after this. But like, that's how I should have just held. I should have handled it as if Calvin said something, or Ricky, or Eagle, or Simon. I should have handled it that way, versus I have all this kind of built up stuff against Paul, and I think that got out, and that's where I think what kind of led to this. Does that make sense? Am I kind of making sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
A little bit. And so my whole thing was like, I just wanted to give my opinion of, I don't know if the best thing to do with the Nico suspension and everything is put it off as like, it wasn't that big of a deal, or the official didn't get intimidated. So technically what Nico was doing wasn't intimidating. I wanted to give that thought, like that's a secondary thought of how, no, I do think this is wrong. And then if we want to discuss like what should happen from that, I think that's fine. But I don't think we should downplay the scenario, was my thought. Mm-hmm. I should have left it at that. Then obviously a bunch of comments came on, and someone had posed a question to Paul about it. And Paul came back with a response of saying, I'm blocked. And then I confirmed that he was blocked. And then that was, I think, the spiral of where even though he has been blocked, I think I literally blocked him maybe not that long after he left.
Yeah, like January, February.
Yeah. So, and a lot of people are like, why'd you block him? To me, I thought it was kind of funny, because knowing Paul, I know he likes to kind of stay in the know of everything. And so to me, I thought it would be funny to block him, to make him have to like sign out of his Twitter and sign into someone else's Twitter to see what I'm saying. I thought that would be kind of funny. But yeah, that's that. I blocked him because I don't want to see any of his stuff, and I want to make it harder for him if he wants to see my stuff. So that's kind of where we're at. I guess now we can kind of give a little more of like a backstory of how we got here. Like, why is Brody upset? Why is Brody, I don't know why I'm talking in third person, but why I'm at the stage I am. And then the goal from all of this is to give at least some information out to you guys, to where people, because again, this is something that has gotten out there, my fault, 100%. We need to address it, and then that way we can move on. I can learn from it, and hopefully we don't have to go down this path again. But because it is a social media thing, and because this is one of those things where me and Paul aren't going anywhere, we're going to stay on playing tournaments and stuff together, that it's not one of those of where it's just like, oh, people will forget about it. It's like, no, this will get brought up every single time there's any sort of interaction between us. So want to get that clear. Again, just apologize for having to do this. Apologize for you guys to have to, you know, start debate night this way, get this out and then move on.
Yeah, it makes sense. So you want to go through kind of how you got to the where you even blocked Paul? Do you want to go through that at all?
Yeah. Do we want to start with like a timeline of kind of the leading up to the point of that
Sure. situation?
on just from like the business side, just a little bit of just how like me getting into foundation, like just from the ground floor, there was obviously lots of talk of, you know, Paul being, you know, his having his disc golf career being what it was, me having my social media career being what it was, being able to work together to kind of build what initially was just kind of a small retail store, right? Like a small online store, to having more of a presence in disc golf. That was kind of our thought. And going into it, obviously everything was in Lynchburg because that's where everyone was. That's where the store was. That's where everything originated. Me being in Dallas, there was always talk about, hey, when the time is right, when I can eventually move over there, because obviously moving from Dallas, where Kelsey has always basically lived, to Lynchburg is a massive move for our family. When the timing was right, I'll make that move. And now that I'm in Lynchburg with everyone, we can kind of really like escalate and not escalate. What's the word that's like accelerate? We can really accelerate a lot of things versus me being away from Lynchburg. So that was the thought process of all of that. And essentially when that all went down of like, okay, guys, I think I'm going to be moving. I came up to Lynchburg several times to look for houses with Kelsey. All that was going on. I thought everything was still groovy. It seemed like everything was still good. We were all doing videos. We were doing social media. Everything was still groovy. And then we ended up making the big move with the three corgis, put them in the car, drove up to Lynchburg, moved in, and I don't know exactly. You'll probably have a better idea of when that was, but it wasn't that long after, I would say. Maybe a month.
No, it was about a month or so, yeah.
A month or so? A month so transpired, and we initially were talking about like, hey, let's all get together and talk, and like we need to kind of figure out some stuff to move forward. And essentially he then said, well, I need to talk to you guys. And kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but we were kind of just like, didn't see it coming, I guess, might have been the right word.
To a certain extent, yeah.
Yeah. Of where he just essentially was, and I don't know how much details. This is why I think it would be better for you to talk, because I don't know how many details you want to give.
Well, I can give a little bit, because I understand Paul's side a little bit more, obviously, because I started the business alongside him. And I think what ended up happening is, to progress to where we're at right now, this past off season, it essentially was when Foundation started, we wanted to be a much more small central, like Central Virginia, Lynchburg hub type thing, right? Where we wanted to be like the disc golf shop for this area, all of that stuff. And the online store was more of a like a way to do so, because we didn't think the Lynchburg area could fund us, which was correct. You know, it's not a huge disc golf hub, but that's where we were. That's where we were passionate about. So we wanted to use the online store as a way to have money to pour into the local scene. That was how Foundation started. You know, fast forward a year into it or whatever, when you stepped in, the opportunity came to kind of pivot what Foundation was and what Foundation could be to something much bigger. It was, we all move forward because it's a no-brainer move, right? Like you have someone coming in who has so much social media presence and stuff like that, can teach us a lot more about the media side, which is something I was very passionate about, and help take the online store to another level. That there is a kind of a shift in Foundation at that point. And I think what essentially happened more or less is that happened during COVID. Obviously, you and Paul were able to be here. We're all just kind of, during that time frame, we were all kind of killing it, right? Like we're all pitching in, doing literally everything for the business we could do. But it was an unrealistic expectation because it was in the middle of COVID. There was no disc golf. There was nothing else pulling attentions away. Disc golf starts back up, all of that. Foundation continues on this new path of online store focus, local scene. We're going to try to get a retail store someday, which now we do have, which is awesome to have, and support. We're able to support the local scene a lot more. That kind of got pushed. The focus shifted a little bit. And I think that focus shift happened in my mind, and that's the focus shift you brought in. But I don't think that's the focus shift that Paul ever had, because he was still passionate about the local scene and the you know, what Foundation started as, if that makes sense. So I think building up to when you moved up here with the intention of like, hey, let's kill social media, let's kill the online store, all of that. And I think that's where it just, Paul wasn't on the same page with that. So then he came in and was like, hey, let's have a meeting. Because now at this point also he had the Paul and Beth Foundation started. You know, obviously his touring career, he was trying to still focus on that. He had a lot of different things pulling him different directions. He also at that time was still trying to build out his course here, which I don't know what the full plan is for that now, but he was still building that out. He had a lot of other things going on, and he felt when he was talking to us, exactly like our post had said, he felt like he just couldn't dedicate the amount of time that basically you and I were dedicating to Foundation, and he felt, I guess in a sense, guilty about that. And was like, I don't know what to do. We talked through several different options, and that's when it led to, okay, so basically the best option here is Paul to be bought out of the business and Foundation move on this path. And that way Paul has, because basically Paul's plate, something had to give. And it was like, which one of these items is going to give? And timing wise, that just obviously sucked for you because you had just moved your whole life up here, like you said. And your intention was move your whole life up here. You know, you and Paul this off season, you, Paul, me, Trevor, we're just going to kill it with videos, get a ton of content out, you know, really drive traffic, really do a bunch of stuff. And then as soon as you get up here, essentially this meeting happened that essentially was like, hey, I don't know if I can dedicate this much time and stuff. And you're like, well, what do you mean? I just moved up here. Is that kind of more or less accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So basically, it was the timing of you just moved your whole life up here.
All the nitty gritty, but yeah, essentially, this would be a completely different scenario had me and Paul not had any friendship, and it was a strictly business thing. I would just be pissed at the person on a business move because it's like you knew I was moving up here for months. Your situation in those months didn't change. It wasn't like something drastically happened to where it's like, hey guys, I just got triplets. I'm going to be swamped. I'm not going to have time for this. So that's where it's like, there wasn't a moment of where something drastically changed in his lifestyle or his life to where I could be like, I could relate to like, oh snap, dude, I completely understand. If you need to take a break or you can't give as much to Foundation as we all expected you to, completely understand. That didn't happen. No conversation happened between me and him. It wasn't until I was already moved up there that all of a sudden he was like, I'm out. And that is where it's like, again, if it was a business only thing, it is what it is. I would just leave it as like, well, I kind of just got screwed over by that business owner. That sucks. But because there is that friendship that was going into it, that's where, again, that's why a lot of times people say like, don't get into business with your friends, because it does get tricky sometimes. And that's where I just felt like, there probably should have been some sort of conversation there. And this is where I think, to easily kind of relate it to a lot of other people, it wasn't like we were moving from Dallas to New York. It wasn't like we were moving from Dallas to Atlanta or Dallas to Chicago. We were moving from Dallas to Lynchburg, Virginia. It is a drastic, for those that don't live in a small town or have never lived in a small town, it is a drastic.
It's a change of pace.
Drastic change. And like, just from my standpoint, not even talking about Kelsey moving away from her whole family and all that, just from my standpoint on like a business side, like I can't even just fly direct. Like I now have to fly from a regional airport to Charlotte and then Charlotte to somewhere else. And so just from a business standpoint, I'm now spending, you know, an hour to 2 hours plus every single time I need to go somewhere. And that was one thing, obviously, from me moving to Dallas, there was a lot of factors into that. But like living somewhere, because I used to live in Jacksonville, in Jacksonville a lot of times was very similar of where I think it was at Jacksonville to Atlanta, I want to say. You had to fly to Atlanta then to be able to fly anywhere else. It might be different now than what it was. But that was like a huge factor for me. It's like just saving. If you're, you know, if I'm flying 300, 400, 500,000 miles a year, you know, being able to shave off some of those times to stay home with the family a little bit more, excuse me, is important. So, So I think that kind of just shows the timeline, I guess, of how things kind of happen, of that. But even then, like at that point, you can probably be upset with someone, but is that enough to really like completely end a relationship? I don't think so. I think it could have been something from there that we could have mended and like talked about and been like, oh man, I dropped the ball here. I'm sorry. Yeah, I dropped the ball here too. I'm sorry. And gone forward. The icing on the cake, if you will, or the thing that really ended up cracking the egg. And again, I'm going to keep this very vague so no one else is kind of thrown into the mix here. But a mutual friend of ours ended up doing something on a very personal level. And I'm one of those people of where myself and my family come before everything else. And if something ends up, if I end up finding out something about that is not good, and I find out that you are somehow connected to it, at that point, the friendship is gonna probably be tarnished. Mm-hmm. On top of that, that's where I confronted Paul and I said, listen, I just got a really reliable source that told me this, or one of our mutual friends did this thing. Is that true? And he said, no, not at all. I later found out from an even more reliable source that not only did the mutual friend do that, but also Paul was in a situation to where could have made that not happen at the beginning. So like he lied to me about that and he was kind of connected to it in a certain way. That was just a no-brainer. I'm not interested in continuing a friendship with that person. And I'm just going to leave it at that. So that's kind of where I was at. Obviously, in my standpoint, like, again, like that's where I was just very upset with everything. And I did not do a good job of seeing people online say like, oh, this is why Paul left Foundation, or this is why Paul and Brody are no longer friends, or this is why Paul and, or this is why Brody blocked Paul. I should have been better at just like letting it go and just being like, is what it is. Let people, you know, whatever. And also it should never have gotten that far. It was my fault that I even got to that point. So, these are all things that I've learned. Obviously I don't really handle drama that well. That's something that I definitely need to work on and do better. And I think the less I get into that realm of the world, the better. And so I'm going to try to completely remove myself of it as much as possible. Obviously, I know this show, we do talk about some things that are happening. I'm going to try to do my best to not like, let's not talk about like the drama stuff so much on this show. Let's keep it more disc golf related stuff that's going on with the PDGA, the Pro Tour. If it is dealing with pros, let's talk about stuff that's happening in between the ropes, if you will, not outside of the ropes, and move forward from that. But hopefully that kind of clears up the air of where me and Paul are at. It is not going to be I do forgive. Like, I don't think it's good to hold something like that. I think I have been holding it for a while, and I think it brings a lot of negative energy and ultimately is not a good thing. So I do forgive, and I want to move on from it. And obviously it's not going to just go over overnight. Obviously there's going to still be tons of comments, tons of people saying, this doesn't make sense. What's going on with this? Why? What I've said here is all I'm going to say. I'm not going to be liking tweets on Twitter anymore of people saying certain things where I'm like, yes, yes, that is what actually happened. I'm not going to be doing any of that. This is all you're going to hear from me from this situation. Not going to bring it up anymore. Gonna move on from it and focus on what I can focus on, and that's that. I don't know if there's anything else to be said on her.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest reasons we had to talk about it to a certain extent was the rumor mill had started churning and stuff was getting said about people, you know, you, Paul, Kelsey, Hannah, that just none of it was true. And it's stuff where like you don't want something like that to get picked up. And people be like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. That has to be the reason. And then Hannah's name get dragged through the mud, or Kelsey's name get dragged through the mud, or yours or Paul's. When like realistically, when people sit back and listen, it's pretty obvious. Like you admitted you made some mistakes. You know, Paul made some mistakes. Friendships don't always just work out. So it's a very like personal thing at the end of the day that's just made public because of social media. And like I said on Grip Locked, you know, to the majority of listeners, it's not something that's like super like, oh, Brody just dropped a bomb. Oh my gosh, I absolutely hate Paul now. Or if you're a Paul fan, you're like, dude, Brody's a scumbag. I absolutely hate Brody. Like, no, it's something where like, I don't think it really should affect people too much as far as like perspectives of one person or the other. People make mistakes. It happened. Like you said, it happened on both sides and it's time to move on. But I think it's good to clear the air so that, like I said, rumors don't spread and people make a bigger deal out of it than it should be. And also so that, because I saw several people saying stuff about Kelsey and Hannah and stuff like that, and you don't want them getting brought into something that is obviously untrue, because I mean that's happened before with other rumors and stuff. So I think it's good just to get out there. It's out there, move on. And hopefully that made sense to everyone. It made sense to me. So hopefully everyone's satisfied and happy now. But let's get back to what started this whole thing, the Nico suspension. Yeah. We talked through the actual suspension length, stuff like that on Grip Locked, but
okay, yeah. I was gonna say I think we only knew that it had happened.
Yeah, we didn't know the suspension length yet.
The PDJ was looking into it. We didn't know anything outside of that.
Yeah, so I mean, because we talked about it on Grip Locked, and Trevor and I were split a little bit, but I more want to hear your side as a player, because if you look at like what Paul's take was, Paul had some technically true things, right? Like it technically was Nico's first time offense. That is technically true. It was an ongoing thing. One thing that I think Paul didn't allude to that I think is a very important piece of information here is when the camera stopped covering it, like Nico just dropped the ball. Like it's not like the camera stopped covering and the situation was over.
Well, apparently, also he refused to talk to anyone after the round.
Which exactly.
I think that made the issue way. I think something could have. I don't know if there would have been that big of an issue if he would have quickly been able to compose himself after the round and said, like, hey, let's sit down, let's talk about it. Because that's essentially.
Well, this is also. Yeah. This is also somewhat hearsay because this is just people who were there and it's been passed through multiple people. But apparently, like, he continued to go after the official, not like in a physical way by any means. I haven't heard anything physical.
Reputable.
Yes, people. I'm just saying I didn't see it with my own eyes. Is why I'm saying it's hearsay. Like I can't say 100% this happened, but people who should know it happened have said like he continued to go after the official, to where the intimidation wasn't just what we saw on screen. I think it's important to note as well. But then you know it comes through. PJ suspends him for 9 months. Which within their guidelines, honestly, is a somewhat light suspension to what it could have been, because it could have been for a Class A offense, 2 years. So 9 months is somewhat light. The thing that shifted Trevor's mindset was the loss of income across those 9 months. To me, I don't see, like, I don't know how much that needs to be factored in, but I want to know your perspective as a player. Like, seeing something like this happen, does your... I don't want to say safety, but like maybe job security is the right word. Like, do you feel affected by the PDJ's decision of like you're now more worried about stuff on the course because you feel like they were too harsh with it? Or do you think, no, like, that's fair? Just treat like I just need to be a professional.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's think about this a little bit of where I think the first thing that's a clear and obvious one is, had it not been Nico, I don't think the suspension length would have been as severe. Now, is that because that person might have been able to talk after the round with someone? Potentially, for sure. But to think that Nico's kind of reputation didn't have any sort of bearing into this, I think is a little naive. It's very similar to like Ndamukong Suh in the NFL, someone that is kind of like not like a pretty known dirty player. Like whenever he did something, it was more eyes were on him, essentially, right? And in this situation, like all eyes were on Nico, and I was not, when it came out with the 9-month suspension, I was not shocked because I knew one, he had all that stuff kind of built up going into this. And then two, I knew the PDGA was going to make an example out of Nico, which is, that sucks. But that is like a common theme in a lot of different other sports of where something happens that's kind of unprecedented on like a live coverage like that. They're going to lay the hammer down a little bit harder to kind of scare everyone. Now we can talk more about what we think it should have been, because I have some interesting ideas on that. But in regards to like me being fearful, like this is also a question that people need to have. Like, how do you want your sport to be? How do you want your sport? Because we talk about this all the time. Like, disc golf is different. Disc golf is different. And it's like, okay, if you are on that line of like, well, disc golf isn't like golf, we should be different. Like, do you want disc golf to be like hockey, where guys can literally meet each other and throw down their discs and start punching each other? Do you want golf to be like baseball, where you can come up to someone and essentially yell so loudly that your spit is hitting them in the face? Like, is that what you want? These are all questions that I think maybe people have different opinions on of how they want. Same thing like tennis. Tennis is another sport where it is not uncommon for someone to get upset with the official, with the umpire, and go up to the chair. I think it's the chair umpire, actually. Go up to the chair umpire and yell at the chair umpire, right? These are all things that happen in other sports. Now, does that happen in golf? No. It would be hard for me to find another situation on live coverage where someone did what Nico did. Got up to someone's face, then that person left, and then he re-got up into someone's face. I'm sure you can find somewhere where two people are talking and one is like yelling or getting very aggressive with the official. I'm sure you can see that. But essentially in the where they redid it, I think that also was an issue. If it would have just been the first altercation, the guy leaves and Nico just yells at him from a distance, I think it would have been not as big of a deal. Like, it wouldn't have been as elevated. But him like re-getting up into the face, kind of re-engaging, I think that's probably what also made the whoever's on the
disciplinary committee
called
disciplinary.
Whoever's on that, probably that escalated, I'm sure, the offense, if you will. But as a player, I mean Nico at one point, I think there's video of him like kicking his mini and it like shot off and like hit a camera guy, I think. Like, again, unintentional, but like something looking like that, like at the end of the day, if you are in control of your emotions and control of what you're doing, like those situations shouldn't happen, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're pissed off and you're going to take your Frisbee and just like spike it into the ground and it somehow slips, or you grip lock it instead of spiking into the ground, it like flings off your finger and hits a kid in the chest. Like, if you just didn't do that initial reaction, that situation never would have occurred. And so I think that's the same thing of like, there's been plenty of times where players have gotten frustrated. I think the question is like, what is acceptable behavior when you're frustrated and what isn't? Do you want what Nico did acceptable? That is at the end of the day what everyone has to answer. And if you answer a yes, or if you answer no, then we can have a discussion of that. But what the PDGA essentially showed is like his behavior is not acceptable. Mm-hmm. Another question that we need to have is like, should the PDGA, should they be like, when they look at the Disc Golf Pro Tour, and this kind of goes into Trevor's standpoint a little bit, suspending someone that plays disc golf as a hobby for 9 months is completely different than suspending someone that plays disc golf for a living for 9 months, right? If Silas goes out to a local flex start and intimidate someone by getting up in their face and being like, did you just call me on a football? And doing that, the PDGA has, I think, every right to be like, we don't want this guy in competing in our events for X amount of time.
Yeah.
This is where it's tricky, because if Silas gets booted there, it's like, Silas is like, oh, that sucks, I can't play like events, but he can still play disc golf and he's still going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Nico not playing in disc golf pro tour events, that really, really hurts him.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, like, this is where, if disc golf was on the level, and this is where it's tough, because if disc golf was on the same level as the sports I had mentioned earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would probably have been like a 1 or 2 tournament suspension, and it would have been a fine. $20,000, $25,000, $50,000. Now, the tricky thing about that is, okay, well, you're fining Nico $25,000, $50,000. Well, that's going to be different than if you're fining the 60th player in the world $25,000 or $50,000. And then it's going to be really different if you're fining Paul or Ricky $25,000, $50,000. You find Paul or Ricky $25,000, $50,000, you're like, ah, that sucks, but whatever.
Yeah.
So, like, that's where it's also weird, because there is such a difference from the top 10 guys to the next 10 to the next 10 of like how much people are making, that you're finding someone $25,000, that's equivalent to them winning like four Elite Series events.
Yeah.
So these are all like, it is not an easy question. I don't actually think there's like an obvious answer of how it should have gone down, as far as like, no, he should have definitely gotten suspended for this. It should have been this long, yada, yada, yada. All I know is like what he did, this is what I think. What he did was incorrect. I don't think that is how you should react. If you want to react negatively, we have tons of guys that do it, myself including, that have like outbursts of negative reaction, but it's all like on myself and it's all on their selves. That's fine. I'm not a huge fan of people like continuing it down the fairway, or like continuing it in your pre-shot and all that stuff. That does happen. That's why I think I kind of draw the line a little bit. But like going up to an official and getting in an official's face, I think hopefully everyone sees like they don't want that to be a common occurrence in disc golf.
Yeah.
I do feel for Nico in a little bit of a way, because like I said, he is the one that's kind of getting, you know, him being the first one, it being on live coverage, all these things happening, like he's being made an example of. So I feel for him on that. I also feel the fact that because he has the history that he does have, it's getting thrown down on him harder than it should have. I will say this, like, I do enjoy playing with Nico. I do enjoy my conversations with Nico off the course as well. But this is something, and hopefully this is kind of like his rock bottom of where it's like, man, I really do need to change some things to move forward.
Because
I do think his playing style as a player is something that is needed in disc golf.
Absolutely.
Him as a personality outside of like the negative stuff is, again, something that is needed in disc golf. I think he adds a lot to it. And so obviously from that side of point, I hope he does figure it out and work on it and get better and come back and play more. Because I do think tournaments are more exciting when he's in the mix.
Absolutely. And I think the reason it's such a weird fine line is, well, there's twofold. A, this wasn't a pro tour event. It was a PDGA major. So it's just strictly by PDGA, and the PDGA and the pro tour for that matter, don't have a way to separate touring pros from just pros. Right. Cause like I am technically a PDGA professional by meaning I pay $75 a year. It's basically what that means. So by the PDGA standard, like, you and I are on a level playing field.
Mm-hmm.
When they look at us, we are both the same type of player. But obviously that's not true, because like you're saying, if I get suspended 9 months, meh, that sucked. Like I've played one tournament in the last 9 months is what it is. It sucks. You get suspended 9 months, or Nico, that looks a lot different. But for the PDGA right now, there is no separation. So when they're looking at it by the rules and objectively, we have to be under the same rules right now. And I think that's where the next step is. Like, A, I think the Pro Tour needs to have a separate set of rules for Pro Tour events. And I think it would be smart for majors to somehow, maybe the Pro Tour pro tour players are still expected to act in the code of conduct at majors or something. I don't exactly know how it would work, but something like that lines up. And I think the pro tour players, that's where a tour card comes in play, because that could be what separates, you know, the average hobbyist from a touring player is, hey, if you have a tour card, it is a privilege to play on the pro tour. It's a privilege to play at these majors. So with that privilege comes this set of responsibilities. And within these responsibilities, that's where it's fine to find someone. Because it's also like, if the PDGA goes straight fine, then if a touring professional gets fined $10,000 or whatever, like you said, there's a wide array where some it's not going to work, some it's easy.
You can't find like a local pro $10,000.
Yeah, but then if I show up and I get fined $10,000, I'm like, what the frick? I play one tournament a year. Like, I'm just never playing disc golf again. You know what I'm saying? So like, the line has to be drawn somewhere.
Yeah.
The line has to be drawn somewhere. So I think that's the key issue that has to be fixed, is there has to be a line that separates touring professionals from your average hobbyist.
Yeah. And again, like, these are all things where now the PDGA, if the Disc Golf Pro Tour and the PDGA continue on to like using these kind of terms or policies for discipline moving forward, there is now a precedent of what Nico did. And again, I do think it was not only elevated because of him kind of getting into the guy's face, but also the fact that after the fact, he refused to talk to anyone about it, which I think is another PDGA policy of where if something happens, like, I think you have to talk to them afterwards. I'm pretty sure. I think I saw that in the policy of where
possibly. I'm not 100% sure.
I think someone brought that up of like, that's like a double strike.
It's kind obviously of a good idea, even if it's not a 100% policy.
I saw wording. I vaguely remember seeing an image where it's like highlighted talking about like the PGGA or the official or the TD or someone will discuss. And like, so that was frowned upon obviously too, but this is now a precedent of like what he did was 9 months. So like, this is where it's going to be interesting, because moving forward, we're going to see, you know, do they stick with that, or is like each situation completely different? Does it matter actually who did it versus the action? But like, thinking all about this, like, I think if the PDGA would have said, hey, we're suspending you for 2 months, right? He would have basically ended up missing Mid-America, Ledgestone, Des Moines, and Worlds. That's pretty devastating.
Yeah.
That's like pretty bad. So like, that's where, again, I don't know exactly how many months it should have been. I don't know if there should have been a fine. I don't know anything about that. All I can say is like, being just taking out of Worlds and saying like, you can't play Worlds this year, that hurts. That hurts pretty hard. So the 9 months, thinking about that, like, all of that's gone. Playoffs, which he was going to qualify for, that's gone. Tour Championship, he was probably going to get into that.
The Tour Championship's an interesting one, because it's not PDGA sanctioned, I don't believe.
Oh.
So that's I could be wrong.
Well, like, USDGC, but
I don't know still, if that is.
USDGC is still PDGA sanctioned, but it's just like an X tier. Yes,
it is. So, but like, he's out of it, yes. But the Pro Tour Championship would be interesting. I'm gonna look it up to see if it's PDGA sanctioned. Because if it wasn't, then that's just up to the Disc Golf Pro Tour.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this is gonna be, you know, this is something that obviously needs to be discussed. I think, again, this is one of those where I think civil discussion about it is important. And I do think a lot of people probably coming into this situation are bringing in all the things that he did in the past. And so when you do that,
it is sanctioned. Okay. I was wrong then. I think in the past it wasn't, because there was some like the format or something, but
yeah,
never mind.
He's out until like Waco or something next year.
Yeah. And to me, what I was expecting was a suspension to like the end of the year. That's what I was expecting. Cause it technically would have been like a long suspension, but it would have just been through October, really. And then the next season, you can just start fresh. Like, you can come back in January. That's where my head is at.
Yeah, if I had to say whether 9 months was too long or too short, I would probably side on the too long side.
Yeah, I would side on too long. I was just looking at the PDGA rules, and I was thinking it's going to be multiple months. it could be up to 2 years. 2 years would have ended his career. So I'm glad they didn't go that way, because you don't come back from 2 year suspension.
No.
So I was looking at it and I was expecting it to be like end of the year, possibly like a few months to where it was through November. Just judging by the PDGA guidelines, I agree. What would have been a better thing would have been a, not even a month length, but like X amount of events plus a small fine. That in my mind is like the best solution, but that only works for, excuse me, that only works for touring pros. And that's my whole point, is like, there is no separation, because like, if you suspend me from five events, then I can just sign up for five events in one weekend and be like, all right, can't play those, I'm back the next weekend. And then if you fine me, like, that doesn't make any sense. You can't be just fining people who weekend warriors, you know, thousands of dollars or hundreds of dollars, or any amount would be incorrect to fine a random hobbyist. But 9 months would have been fair for me, because like, no one in the local scene, if I did that to a local official, no one in the local scene would want to see me for 9 months. That makes sense. Yeah. So I think that's where there just has to be a separation.
It is a committee that I do not have any interest in being on, because it seems like it would be so hard to make the right decisions, because again, like that, there's so many different levels of players, and there's so many different players on the pro tour. So even if you were just like, hey, this is how we're going to handle people that aren't on the pro tour, this is how we're going to handle people that are on the pro tour, even the way you handle people on the pro tour is going to be vastly, vastly different. Like, it's so hard to like,
it could also be, I think it should be said the PDGA made the right decision because of how things currently are. So like, with the current guidelines and stuff, the PDGA made the decision they had to make, because like, you had to treat it just like any other player. You couldn't treat it special, because now if they did treat it special because it's Nico in a negative way, that's the wrong decision.
Correct.
So if it was like any bias shown towards Nico, that's the wrong decision. But as far as
I have a hard time seeing like, I'll just throw like someone that I, you know, is like a no nice guy, like a Zach Melton. I have a hard time seeing, if you literally throw Zach Melton into Nico's body. No, if you throw Nico into Zach Melton's body and that exact thing transpires on live coverage, I have a hard time seeing like, and I could be wrong. I could be wrong, but I have a hard time.
I would hope you're wrong, but I also fully understand what you're saying. You're like, I agree. It's hard to imagine a big germ, Kevin Jones, Zach Melton, someone like that getting the same type of treatment. What I think the right decision is I think the Pro Tour, like I said, tour card, it seems like they're already heading that way. Once they're there, I think it could be either or.
Yeah.
What?
Well, I was going to say different rules, and then also different policy too. They can have they can have their own situation of like, if the Nico situation happens, you are going to be suspended from the next four elite series / majors, whatever comes first situation, kind of thing like that, and you will be fined X amount of dollars.
Well, that's what I was saying, is I think the fine, it can be like, let's say that it was a $5,000 fine.
That's high.
Two event suspension. Or you $5,000 fine, two event suspension, or your options are do that or no fine and like a six event suspension.
Oh, so player decision.
Well, that way, if it's a player who can't afford the fine, right? Like, because disc golf is such a delicate thing where you have players that like a $5,000 fine is nothing. Like, there's a rounding error on my accounting balance sheet, and a $5,000 fine is like, I literally can't play disc golf again.
I know, but I'm going to have to disagree with you on that, because I do like it in the sense of like, the player can kind of bet on themselves. It'd be like, oh, I'm going to pay the fine, I can make that back up in these tournaments. So I kind of like that, just kind of like that aspect of it. But like, if you are a player that is living by, you know, tournament to tournament, right? And we know that there are players on tour right now that literally they need a cash to stay on tour, essentially. If you do the 5,000, and this is where I think we get some of the comments of where, like, if you know that that's how you are, then just don't make that mistake. And it's like, yes, I kind of understand that. It's still like, this is where I disagree with the Paul take, is because I do feel like a lot of Paul's blame on the situation was like, he was just kind of alleviating anything like Nico did was fine, and then like the official was the one that's the wrong, and the PDG the one that's in the wrong, when I think we can disagree on what the outcome was, but I don't think we can agree on the situation. So like, I do see the take of like, if you can't afford a fine or you can't afford to miss tournaments, then you really need to be on your best behavior when you're out on tour. I get that. But if we are talking about like what's fair and what's not, those lower level guys, like I think the $5,000 fine kills them. They're off. And I think also extending the suspension to 6 months or something also kills them. So
it might, yeah.
So like, I don't know.
I'm just saying, like, if we go $500 fine, that's basically two event entry fees. That also would knock some players off tour, but then it's such a small fine for the top players that where's the penalty there?
I have to start that way.
I think you might have to. That's where I was just thinking of like ways that's going to resonate with each player, and it's like an either or, because it might be like, hey, you know what? I'm going to just pay the $5,000 so I can keep touring, or all right, I got to find a job for 6 months.
Maybe you do something where it's like you have to supply water for one of the practice days.
You become, oh, that'd be funny. You're the next event, you have to,
oh,
you have
volunteer,
to work for the pro tour.
Volunteer your time at the...
Yeah. It's a mandatory community service, not
you
a suspension.
You have to wear like the dunce hat that they used to make people wear back in
school.
Just
we'll make a suspension shirt that says like, I didn't choose to be here or something like that.
Yeah.
People just know, oh man, that guy got suspended last week.
Public humiliation always makes people not want to mess up. So
yeah, maybe that's
all right. So I think that's the Nico situation. Obviously, there's still you're always going to have people on different sides. And I think at the end of the day, I don't think there is a clear cut, like this is definitely what should have happened. But, you know, I think moving forward, I think the decision that everyone needs to make, players as well as fans and stuff, is like, what do we want to be? Like, what's the of being like, this is okay to do, this is not okay to do? Because I was actually very interested in seeing how, you know, a lot of people were, Paul, coming from a baseball background, he might have the notion of like getting up into an umpire's face is fine.
Yeah.
I don't agree with it, but there might be people out there also that are like, no, I want to see players get up into umpires' faces and stuff like that. I want to see that. That's where I think people need to kind of figure out what they want to see and what they don't want to see.
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, I do want to get into Ledgestone a little bit. I don't know if you want to run us through your play at all. Obviously, you had us on the edge of our seat.
Were you watching the cut line? Or not.
I was watching the cut line hard. Someone posted in,
man,
I think it was in the Foundation Nation group, and said something about you missing the cut. And I commented, I was like, I don't know, man. Northwood's black. That cut line's moving. And then sure enough, it just kept moving closer and closer and closer to you until you were within the cut line.
The finishing of that course is so good, because the front nine is loaded with like scoring opportunities, right? So you definitely want, if you're going to go low, unless you're Calvin, that shot 6 under on the back, which is absolutely insane. If you're going to go low at Northwoods, you got to stack up birdies early, right? On that front nine. And then kind of in that section of like hole 11, even hole 10 is kind of tricky a little bit, but definitely hole like 11 through 15, that's where it's just like, hang on as hard as you possibly can. Like if you can get to like 11 through 15, even par, I think everyone on tour would take that. And then 16 and 17, birdie chances. 16, very tough. I wish there was maybe some OB on 16, because 16 I do think is tough to make a bogey. But that is one of the few holes where you step up and you're like, I need to try to get a birdie on this hole. 17, they did make it easier by like not making it so much of like an island. They kind of took out the OB short, which I actually think is a pretty good, I actually like the change. But 17 is another one where it's like, if I throw one good shot here, I can make a birdie. If I throw one bad shot here, I'm instantly making a bogey. So like those two down the wire, pretty nice. And then 18 is just a tough hole. 18 is a really tough birdie, and not as tough to just somehow find yourself having a 40 footer for par. So I think 18 is a good finishing hole as well. And yeah, like obviously going into that round, I knew that I needed, I felt like I needed to get to three over, or sorry, I felt like I needed to get to two over to for sure solidify myself in. Mm-hmm. I thought three over was going to be like the, I might get in, but I'm going to need a lot of help. It turned out that four over actually what I ended up finishing. Four over was good enough to make it into Sunday. But yeah, I was playing 18. I was four over for the tournament at 18. I think I was, I was even par, I think, for the round. And I was playing 18 with the idea of like, I need to birdie this to basically get in. So I went super aggressive off the tee, didn't work out, got into some trouble, went super aggressive again, didn't work out, got into some trouble, threw like my pink ringer on this crazy like flip line, whatever, to get to 40 feet. And at that point, like these are all things where I think having a cut is also super beneficial for like players at my level too, because I was able to have one of the most pressured putts, probably the most pressured putt of the tournament. I'm sure there was other people. I know like some other people had similar putts on 18 to make the cut, but like Ricky never had a pressure putt on 18, on like he was up by what, a couple coming into the last stretch.
Yeah, I mean he double bogeyed 17, but it wasn't enough to make it even close on okay. Eureka.
Okay, so like he didn't have a situation, but like sometimes like you do have those pressure putts like coming down to like I need to make this putt to win, or I need to make this putt to make sure that whatever. Like I had that even though I was in 59th place, and so I think that's also a good thing for like the mid level guys as well. Of where we can get some work and practice of like playing that round. Cause obviously going into the third round, we all know we have no chance of winning. Like,
yeah.
Well, what am I going to do? Shoot 18 under at Northwoods and then shoot at Eureka. Okay, sure. So like, it is a nice thing to have of like having that pressure of like, if I play well, I get to play tomorrow. If I don't, I go home. And so, yeah, I had that 40 footer and knew that I had to make it to give some sort of a chance, and ended up making it. And then, yeah, I was staring at UDIS for the next hour and a half, and I was just like watching people fall down the leaderboard left and right, which is not
people just slowly trickled down.
Not hard to do out there. It's not hard to do.
Yeah.
So,
now Northwoods is an interesting one because, like, I had the take on Griplock that I don't think the Pro Tour should come back there until the coverage gets solved because. FPO final round, we don't get to watch until the back nine. MPO's round two and three, we don't get to watch till the back nine. So where do you think the line is as a player on the Pro Tour where, as a player, obviously Northwoods Black, Eureka Temp, they're great compliments to each other, makes the event one of the more special events. But as a fan, and obviously you can watch it on Jomez, Gatekeeper, all of that, but the Pro Tour is asking us to be paid subscribers to watch live coverage, and then we don't get half the round live. How much do you think the Pro Tour should cater to viewers versus catering to players in a scenario like Northwoods?
I mean, that's definitely an interesting one. You know, they have to. I think it's tough because there aren't that many like pro level wooded courses out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I quickly put Northwoods Black, and I didn't really have that much say on Northwoods Gold. I played it once 2 years ago,
My
game was just like, I mean, I was just, I had no business being out there playing that course. So now that I think I'm at a level to where I can actually have a decent idea about course design and how the course plays for professionals, that, I mean, one round through Northwoods Black and I was like, this is a top three wooded course. It's right up there with Doug Jackson, right up there with New London. And that's where it's tough because it's like, after that, I haven't played GMC or Maple Hill, so I'm excluding Brewster and I'm excluding Maple Hill because I haven't played those yet. But when you have like a small list of courses that are like at that level, it is tough. I think from the Pro Tour side, it's tough to also just like be like, deuces, we're out. And then also Ledgestone just being as, you know, having the history that it has there. And all the money that it brings in and all that, I think it's also hard for the Pro Tour to just say, like, deuces, I'm out. So I can see it from a spectators, from a fan standpoint, it sucks. It's yeah. awful. Like, it's awful. You can't. Yeah. That's like me watching the Tour de France back in the day. Like, I didn't realize that one of the smaller networks actually just had the Tour de France like start to finish. So like, I only thought, I can't remember what it was, but it was like, it was either NBC or ESPN. It was like one of the bigger networks. I thought like that was the only way I could watch the Tour de France. And like, you would go into it with like an hour left of the race. And then they mm-hmm. would show highlights of what happened 3-4 hours previously during the race. It wasn't until I found out about this like other channel that I could like, wait, I can wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I can watch the start to the end. Like that,
yeah.
the whole viewing experience for me. I love that so much more. And I think it's probably equivalent to here, where I think there are some people that are like, yeah, just give me the highlights, whatever. It's not that big of a deal. But the people that are like the diehard fans that want to see everything, it's a bad product. It's not a good product. And that's where I think it's tough for the Pro Tour of like, how do we make it work? Because clearly it's an incredible course, but how do you give a product off that is at the level that you want to your paying subscribers?
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's the key is paying subscribers, because like, if it was a free product, then it is what it is. I wouldn't be that upset. But like, you have people paying to watch live disc golf. It's arguably one of the biggest Pro Tour stops of the year, but one of the hardest courses of the year as well. Like, I want to see that. And then obviously, like I said, I can go watch Jomez and stuff, but on Jomez or on Gatekeeper, you're not getting the full story of the round because you're watching one card or the other. You're not getting Corey Ellis is super hot 3 cards back or whatever's going on. That's what I want. That's how I personally enjoy consuming disc golf. And that's also how I'm paying to consume disc golf. So, and the final round for FPO, like I said, you don't get the full story there at all. And so it was very frustrating. And
that's worse.
It's like, yeah, because it's the final round. At least for MPO, it was round 2 and 3 where it's like story building rounds, but it's not the climax of the event. Mm-hmm. For FPO, first round of FPO, not a huge deal because like everyone's starting even. So like, you're not really missing that much. You're missing the feature cards, but you're not really missing that much. Final round, it's like, that's what you got to be watching.
And of course, like Northwoods too, you could have someone that like is in contention to win, and then you tune in and they're like, yeah, they're out. And you're just like,
yeah,
what?
Exactly.
Like, how they get,
exactly.
How they get there. So yeah, I can definitely see how that can be frustrating. But again, mm-hmm. it's where I don't know how to fix it. Like, I don't know what they need to do or how to. I
don't either. That's why I didn't. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, I just don't know where it's a decision where the Pro Tour / Disc Golf Network, because obviously the same entity to a certain extent, they just have to make a decision of like, what's the priority? Is the priority the event and the players, or is our priority the spectating of the event with the live viewers at home? Because like, if the priority is the players, then it rolls on and we do the best we can with the viewership at home. I still think there's options they could do where you still go live at the beginning and are just fed, you know, highlights, and it's more of like an analysis thing going on. I think there's options. But if the priority is the paying subscribers, then you can't go to Northwoods until the coverage is there. Like, those are the two options, I think.
What if they did this? What if they went live? Because I know they were going like live later than normal, right? What if they went live normal time and they were just showing people that had earlier tee times on the back nine, right? And then once they kind of got the footage of the players on the front nine, maybe they get like one or two guys that film front nine stuff, and they bounce to the whatever, send that over while other people are still filming, and they kind of switch. So they can kind of like, it's not as delayed, but still delayed highlights of what's going on the front nine.
Yeah. That's exactly what I think should happen.
Yeah. While you're watching what's actually happening right now on the back nine from
like
early cards.
When they go live on the back nine, they're able to show us highlights of what happened on the front nine. You see little glimpses of like, this is what Paul was doing, Ricky, whoever. This is what they were doing on the front nine. So they have a way to get those glimpses, obviously. So to me, I think you go live and you just have like two analysts, right? And they're talking about like the round we're about to watch, all of this, blah, blah, blah. then you start pulling in some highlights from the front nine, and then you're like, wow, so-and-so is having a great round. Let's actually hop into them live on hole 12. Let's see how they're playing hole 12. You're watching hole 12. While that's going on, lead card's paying 2 and 3, and you're getting that footage uploaded however you need to. So then you're like, all right, while that was happening on hole 12, here's what happened with so-and-so on 2 and 3. And it's more of like a storytelling until you get to the back nine.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that. That solves it for me. But like, just not going live. Like, MPO didn't go live till 6 o'clock. FPO, it was 1 o'clock Eastern or something like that. And just you're watching on UDisc and you're seeing all this stuff happening, and you're just like, I want to watch it live, but I'm missing literally half the round. That what happened, and it's happened for several years, I don't think that's the solution at all. I think there is a solution, but I think they gotta figure it out before next year, for sure. So obviously now we're rolling into Des Moines. You're out there. Last year you said Des Moines was one of your favorite events of the year, correct?
Oh, the crowd out here, the crowd, for how many people show up, they are loud. They are very knowledgeable disc golfers as well. So they know when there's a good shot. They know when it's a bad shot. Like, this was definitely, as far as an event goes, this was definitely one of my favorites to play last year. And also just the course is, you guys would love the course. It's the equivalent, the best way for me to explain it for you guys is like, it's like Falling Creek Golds on steroids. It's like, it's a really,
heck yeah,
it's a really freaking good course. I there are courses that we have on tour that you know, W.R. Jackson, Northwoods Black, like courses that I would say, if these were in my area, if I lived near these courses, like I would practice here all the time. I would just come here and practice all the time, not just because it's good practice, but also because it's really fun. And there are some courses where, you know, any of the Las Vegas challenge courses, like those are courses where it's like, if I lived in the area, maybe I go out there and play once in a while, but I'm not very interested in playing those courses. Des Moines is one of the ones that I would play all the time. It is a lot of fun to play all the time. It has so many different shots that it requires you to throw. It's got a great mixture of like long par four or long par threes, short par threes. It's got a couple island green holes where it puts a little pressure on you. Has two really good par fives. I wish 18. The only thing I'll say is like with 18, I think it would be sweet because it is a sick par five. But I think like AB might have been like the only one that was like somewhat close to like going for it. And I don't even think he ended up getting that close, if I remember correctly. But it is so uphill for your initial tee shot that if they were somehow to like build like almost like a platform like you see in diving, right, where we have to like walk up a spiral staircase like 30 feet to where we can throw up really high, I think then that hole becomes a hole where you can play super aggressive and go for the eagle, but also the risk is there of where you can mess up and throw a B and have to take it back really, really far. So 18 is an incredible finishing hole as a par five. It's just, you can't get an eagle right now at all, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So that would make that hole just so much better if there was some sort of way of like throwing two risky shots to try to get an eagle. But it's a great course, man. I don't know how well it does filming wise. I don't know what if it does a good job, you know, on live to like show how awesome of a course it is, but it's a fun one.
Nice. Yeah, I feel like it did last year. I don't remember too much about it. I remember some of the signature signature holes of the course, but I'm definitely excited to watch it again this year. We're going to do the preview show on Griplocked Thursday, because it starts on Friday, so we're gonna do the preview show on Thursday, get all the details and stuff like that out. But I remember you were talking a lot about it last year, hyping it up, mainly because of the crowd, but also like you were saying the course. But anything else, any other storylines that I'm missing?
I mean, it'll be interesting too, like this year, obviously, with it being right before Worlds last year, it was a very limited field. This year, everyone's here. So I think it's also going to add a little
That's a great point.
Last year, it was kind of a little bit under the radar. I was just watching coverage, and the lead card, the final day lead card was Paul, Raven Newsom, Gavin Rathbun.
Yeah.
Oh man, I'm blanking on the fourth guy. Oh, I can literally see his face. Oh
I'll
man,
hold up. I don't remember either.
Literally just watch this. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the top name people last year. I think I don't know what the timing was last year. I just don't think it was good timing. So I think
was
a lot
it Ben
of
Ben Callaway.
It was Ben Callaway. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly what it is. So
yeah.
So yeah, there wasn't the field wasn't. And again, like the funny thing is if you told me that was the lead card this weekend, I wouldn't be surprised. It wouldn't be like, oh my gosh, no one's there. Like just with how crazy the Pro Tour has gotten now to where people just sneak in. They don't even sneak in. There's just a lot of good disc golfers now. But like, I think that shows from like last year, if you look at that lead card versus lead cards of every other tournament, essentially, you can kind of see like, ah, we're like, did Calvin have a bad day? Did like Chris Dickerson, did Eagle, Ricky, like where is everyone? They just weren't there, I don't think. So
Calvin was there. He just shredded the final round to get up in there. So he wasn't on the
lead card. Calvin was there.
Yeah. He finished in second, I believe I just saw. But
oh,
he
no,
shot
he
like
did.
A 51
he
or something.
Did. Yeah, I do remember that. He shredded the final day. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I stand corrected. But yes, it wasn't as big of a field, as deep of a field as other Elite Series events last year. But this year it will be. And honestly, every tournament from here on out, excluding the Silver Series, which is I think is like the Pittsburgh Open.
Pittsburgh one.
Yeah. Every tournament here on out is going to be very important.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. It's like how
points are
because obviously it's still just a Pro Tour event. It's not playoffs yet, but it's the last true Pro Tour event before the playoffs. Like, is there added pressure of any kind? Because you have the major, which has more points. You have a Silver Series, which if you need points from the Silver Series, it's probably going to be a little rough because Silver Series don't get you that many points, unfortunately. Yeah. But realistically, this is your one of the last chances to get inside the cut line. Do you think that there are a lot of players that's adding extra pressure going into it?
I mean, I think, again, I think this has a lot to do with the purse of the Tour Championship, right? The Tour Championship is very new, so there isn't, like, the prestige that is built up. Like, Nathan Queen winning the winning the Tour Championship last year didn't do nearly as much as if he would have won Worlds, USGC, or European Open, right?
Yes.
But
yeah.
His paycheck or his bank account, his bank account doesn't care. Like, he's very happy that he won that. So I think from a player standpoint, everyone realizes how important it is to get into the playoffs. And this is the first year that the playoffs existed too. So that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But yeah, I mean, like going into the final day of Ledgestone, like I was playing ultra aggressive because getting 50th place didn't matter. Getting 49th didn't matter. 48th, nope. 47th, nope. 46th, nope. 45th, nope. I need to get 43rd or better because anything outside of that doesn't matter. I'm not getting any points. So I think you're going to see that too from some guys of where it's like, you got to play a little bit differently now because it's no longer, let me play safe and try to finish as high on the leaderboard as possible. It's like, if I don't get better than 44th at this tournament, it is essentially a meaningless tournament to me. Because
some players. Yeah, I mean, some players that I believe, let me make sure these players are registered. They are. That's going to be interesting to watch. That's
important.
Is Chandler Kramer currently outside the cut for the Pro Tour Championship or as of right now? Obviously, you have the playoffs and stuff coming in.
Is he outside
Connor O'Reilly?
Are these outside the play-in or these are the play-in people?
These are outside of the play-in.
Outside the play-in. Interesting. Okay.
Yes. So he's in 37th. Marweed is the cut for the play-in at 36th. So Chandler Kramer, Connor O'Reilly, Nicholas Antia, Vino Makela, Nate Sexton's an interesting one. He's outside the cut. He's not registered for Des Moines. He is registered for Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be interesting to watch. But there's a lot of good players that you can, you know, these next few tournaments are really going to be telltale of do they even make that play-in event. And then there is also the sideline of like Chandler Fry, Greg Barsby, Eagle that are right now on the bubble of getting past the play-in and into the actual like you're just straight up qualified. You don't have to do the play-in event. So it's definitely going to be interesting to watch as this shakes up. And I think the playoffs are going to give a lot. I think it's going to be more exciting this year. It's going to give GMC and Maple Hill a little bit more meaning than, I mean, obviously they already had meaning, but a little bit more, because now you're really going to be watching that cut line and how things shake up to see where players end up and do they even make it to the next event. You know, I think I really like how the playoffs are lining up this year.
Yeah, and we didn't really even discuss that much about Ledgestone as far as, we probably should discuss a little. I know obviously Grip Locked is, you guys talked probably at length at it, but you know, Ricky getting his third win this year, I think that clearly obviously elevates him above everyone else for being like basically the player of the year, essentially, right? It's hard to give it to anyone else at this point. It will be interesting. One factor would be interesting, like if Eagle wins European Open and if he wins Worlds, you're gonna have so many people being like, "Oh, he would have won like 10 times if he played this year." So you're gonna have that.
If Eagle gets another major win, if he wins Worlds or USDGC,
is he playing? And
I would imagine. I mean, I don't know why you'd play Worlds and not USDGC. Okay. I think he's just basically playing the majors. So if he can come in and he wins European Open and then Worlds or USDGC, and like that's basically what he did for the year, it's a valid argument of like, could he be player of the year? Because like, but he didn't really, like he lost some at the beginning of the year and he was hurt, but like when the lights were brightest, he won. It'll be weird.
It would play so well for him because he wouldn't have to say anything, but everyone would be like, "Oh, bro, if Eagle played every tournament, he'd win like 7 times. So
yeah, it'd be fascinating. It'd be fascinating. And it's realistic because DDO is going to play, which basically Worlds, that's going to play well for Eagle. So like Eagle on those courses, it's those are going to play decently for him. So he has a shot at Worlds, and he's obviously done very well at USDGC in the past. So he has a strong shot there. You know, if he's able to just put some stuff together, it's not unrealistic to think he walks away with one of the other two. And if he wins two of the four majors in a year, I mean, that's pretty unprecedented. That'd be something. So, but as of right now, yeah, there's no argument against Rick. And in my opinion, I think Ricky's the favorite to win Worlds. He won DDO somewhat handedly. He's won Worlds there before. I think he's by far the favorite right now, but it will be a much different tournament because the wind will be drastically less if the weather stays true.
Did you guys talk about anyone like surprising you at Ledgestone or anyone? Because I think Ledgestone is also a tournament that, because of the two different playing styles of like the hardest wooded course ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Play on tour, and then a very hard open course, in the sense of like, if you're off, if you're not playing well, you can take huge numbers at Eureka. But mm-hmm. It is a course where, like Northwoods, if you're playing well at Northwoods, that doesn't guarantee that you're going to shred it. If you're playing well at Eureka, you're going to shred. So, was there anyone that you guys were surprised with how well they did at that? And was there anyone that you were shocked of like, "Oh man, that person missed the cut"? Or, "Oh, wow, that person wasn't even in the equation all week"?
Yeah, I was surprised by two players in particular. One, Anthony Barella. I was more surprised. I thought that he was going to crack in round three. Going into round three with a chance at Northwoods, not a course that you would think AB, it's going to be like a super AB-friendly course, and he held it together. Obviously, he didn't end up winning, which I was hoping he was going to selfishly. I love AB. He ended up struggling a little bit on Eureka. I was surprised that he stayed in contention through three rounds. Another player that's been surprising me as of late somewhat, because I feel like he's just someone people didn't really know too much about. I had heard about him previously from Florida stuff, but Randon Lada, I believe is how you say his name. Yeah, Randon Lada.
Last year.
He's a very solid player, and he's been having some decent finishes as of late. So he somewhat surprised me to get up in the mix. He tied for eighth here. He was, I believe, let me look here, 15th at D-Glow. Both of those are impressive finishes. So, and also, he, I don't know if you saw his outfit, but like he rocked a like super old school golf outfit.
The hat.
Like with the hat and like the four. I loved it. So got some style points there. Player that negatively surprised me was Dickerson. I really thought, with Northwoods being the course that basically you need to win or lose at, really thought Dickerson was going to be a lot more in contention than he was. I think he ended up finishing 19th at 8 under par. He lost by almost 20 strokes. And the Dickerson we've seen all year, I didn't pick him for my top three. I forget why. I think I just had a feeling. And luckily for me, points-wise, my feeling was right. But if I was just looking at objectively a course and an event, I would say, like, hey, Dickerson's going to do well here. So for him not to do well there, that really surprised me. Those are my three. What about you, Silas? I don't think you've said anything this whole podcast. Anyone surprise you?
Again, AB. I you know, just getting into, I mean, I haven't been around the sport a whole lot, but he hasn't really been in contention a whole lot. So to hear his name up there is pretty impressive, and hope, you know, he seems like a cool guy. Hopefully he stays up there. But yeah, that's kind of that's most of the
who underperformed, Size. That's what people really
who
want.
Who underperformed?
You can say Brody if you want.
Well, yeah.
I did underperform, but
yeah. Well, yeah, I think so. I think everyone would agree.
Ooh,
with
I got
that.
Another good one.
I might have overperformed.
I got another good one.
Hunter, I might have overperformed since I 100% overperformed since last Ledgestone that I played.
Yes. Yes, but current year expectations were a little higher than barely making the cut, at least on my end.
No, I agree.
This is one another player, Simon Lazat, has been a little bit on the struggle bus recently. I didn't expect him to play well because I don't think Northwoods really suits his game that much. But
I think it does, actually.
Really?
Yeah, playing with him, like, he's very – he has – like, Northwoods is all about being able to just stay up. And again, like, this is something that, like, when you watch live coverage and, like, they'll give you, like, the three things you need to do on a course, like, every single time, they're like, stay in the fairway. But this is actually a course that it is way more important to throw, like, a 350-foot shot in the fairway than throw a 450-foot shot in the fairway. Like, it is way better to, like, take less risk and throw something that you know you can throw straight and keep it in the fairway than trying to throw like a fairway driver further up. And playing with Simon a couple times this year, like he has a really good mid-range game where he can throw those straight shots, and he can throw that, like, also that fairway shot that, like, goes straight for 300 feet and then starts slowly breaking to the right. Like, that's another very important shot to have. But I think these are, if we played Northwoods and Eureka, if we played this tournament every other weekend, right? If we just came back every other weekend, I think you would be surprised with how shooken up the leaderboard would be. It is a tournament where I was talking to someone about this the other day, of where how scary it is going in and playing like a course where you just, like, don't have confidence in a certain throw. And these courses, like, if you are struggling with your, like, hyzer flip or your forehand isn't where it needs to be, like, you can't really hide. So those guys that are coming in and that are just not feeling a certain part of their game, they're going to get kind of exposed on these courses. And yeah, I think this course is a course, like, next year, if we come back and he wins by 10, I wouldn't be surprised.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, well, you know, I have to take a mental note so that next year I can pick Simon to win by 10.
Here's another question that we were talking about the other day, was trying to, like, if you are an owner of, you know, like a soccer Premier League, right? You've got scouts all over the world looking at, like, young talent coming up, and you're like kids at like 13, 14, 15, right? Do you think you could point out local talent like that in disc golf?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. I don't think you can.
You don't think I could, or just in general, no one could?
I think it'd be very hard. It'd be very hard to, like, be able to look at results of, like, local kids and be like,
no, you couldn't use just results. You'd have to watch them throw. You couldn't use just results. You'd have to watch them.
Well, okay, are you under, because we were kind of talking about power, right? We were talking about like distance, power, how to generate it. And we were trying, like, we were talking about how, you know, you watch some people and you're just like, you might keep saying like, oh, they're, when they get more muscle, or like when they start figuring, and you start kind of keep saying like, oh, this is all that needs to happen. But they end up still not throwing further. Like they stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that is potentially the most important thing when you're like looking at, if you're looking at like a 13-year-old,
mm-hmm.
I think it's tough. I don't know.
I'd be looking at three things. I'd be looking at their actual backhand and forehand form, so the basics of it.
Okay.
Because like if it's something where they have really good timing and stuff, then yeah, you're right. It's just like you gotta develop. But if there's something else holding them back, that's gonna be a weird one. But like Gannon Burr, for instance, he's had basically the same form and it's been a good form for a long time. So it was pretty obvious he was eventually gonna be able to throw far. Then I would look at their putting stroke.
See, like he throws far enough, but I wouldn't say he throws far.
But he throws far enough to compete, which you could have predicted Gannon Burr was going to be. You could have predicted Gannon Burr was going to be this good. You couldn't predict he was going to be this good this early. You could predict he was going to be this good.
Maybe this is a question I need to ask Gannon. Like, I want to ask him, like, 3 years ago, were you throwing just essentially just as far as you're throwing now? Because.
No, he wasn't. When he came up, he said, I forget when he started throwing, but he was throwing far, but not as far.
Because I think that is like, you could have someone that could just crush local tournaments throwing like 350 feet, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the age of like 13 or 14 or 15 or whatever, right? I think it's tough to be able to tell whether or not that person, when they get older, is going to be able to throw 500 feet or not.
Well, no, but I think the third thing would be the most important, which is the shot selection. Because if they're throwing 350 feet and they're dominating local tournaments, but it's because they have a full flex shot. That's why you can't look at just scores. Because if they're doing it with a full flex shot with a driver, and it's like, okay, yeah, they're throwing 350, but like, are they ever going to be able to throw that far? Versus if they're able to just like throw flip-ups with a fairway, and the reason they're not throwing 500 is they just don't understand quite yet how to get a disc to do what a disc needs to do to go that far. But their shot selection is like, they're throwing 350, and if that shot selection just gets to 400, they're on the same level as the pros. Then, and also the shot selection in tough situations, like if a player, you can't teach understanding of the game. Like if a player understands like when to be aggressive, stuff like that, they're going to make mistakes, obviously. But
yeah,
I think watching a player's understanding of the game and shot selection on the tee, shot selection in the middle of the fairway, and then their putting stroke and their backhand form, I think you could very, not 100% accurately, but you could very quickly tell that player's got potential, or like it's going to take a lot of work for that player to get from 15-year-old them to 20-year-old world champ.
Versus easier like Gannon, or basketball?
I would say slightly harder, because the way you're watching them, it's so course dependent. Because like if the only place you can watch a player is a course like Falling Creek, they might look incredible, but you might be missing when you put them in the woods, they really struggle X, Y, or Z. A basketball court's a basketball court. So like the competition might make them look better or worse, but there's some things where like if a player does something, regardless of competition, you're like, okay, that's special. And the basketball court, you're not going to move them to Madison Square Garden and the rim height change. But you move someone from Falling Creek to Northwoods Black and a lot changes. So I think it'd be harder because the surroundings, if that makes sense.
I think the mental side too, of
yeah,
like obviously you do see this sometimes in other sports of where like, you know, players do crack, but I think a lot of that is more of like the effort. I think you know you get these big contracts and stuff, and maybe they're not putting in as much time as they used to, but. I think it's harder to crack under the pressure in sports that move very fast, of where you're doing Absolutely. A lot more reactionary stuff than sports that are very slow, like disc golf. And so that is another like outside factor of where it's like it's tough to tell whether or not someone has it or not until they're kind of put into that situation. Because you could have someone that's just like, it's way easier going into a tournament knowing like I can play bad and beat everyone. Right,
mm-hmm.
takes a lot of that pressure off versus going into a tournament where now you're just one fish in the pond of many. And yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that goes. But yeah, I think it's definitely, I'm curious to hear what size has to say, but I think it's definitely harder to look at a 15-year-old disc golfer and be able to tell whether or not they're going to be successful on a pro tour and a 15-year-old basketball player and be able to tell whether or not they're going to be successful on the pro in the NBA, just simply because of like how much athleticism comes into, you know, if you do have like a 6'10", 6'8", 15-year-old that's just an athletic freak, you're like, okay.
Well, you can take a look at the competition.
It was easy. Zion was the easiest pick of all time.
Like, you're like, as long as he stays healthy and as long as he keeps practicing, he's going to be in the NBA. Where disc golf, I agree with you, where it would be tough to – it'd be tough to do that. All right, Saz, why is it –
Well, the good
– Yeah, look at the competition. I mean, if I'm 6 foot and – in eighth grade, and I'm just dunking on everyone on my, you know, little tiny school that's got.
That's not where I was going. What the heck?
Why not?
No, because like I had
going to saying that there's like less competition in disc golf, so there's a better chance that someone that's good younger is going to get into disc golf.
That's a good point.
Then I thought that's what you're like the amount of like good like basketball kids growing up that are in AAU and all that stuff, traveling teams, way outnumbers the amount of good kids that are playing.
Oh, absolutely.
So like that's what I thought you were going.
If you're playing against a trash team, like a good player, obviously, yeah, they're gonna drop 40 on a trash team, but you'll be able to tell how they dropped 40. Because like if they dropped 40 because like there was a guy that I played against, he was a 7-footer. And he went to a local school, and he's 7 feet tall. Like, you think this guy's go, and he dominated our league because we're all small schools. But you could tell when he was playing, he's not going to do anything. Like, you could tell by his footwork. Like, the reason he's dominating is because he's 7 foot, and it's just coming to him, and he's just laying up.
If he had someone roughly the same size as him, or even close to him, he's probably not doing anything.
Exactly, because, like, I was in high school, I'm the same height as I am now, 5'10", 5'11". I had to guard him sometimes because I was the only one who's physical. But I could get him three or four times. But his dunks were weak, so it was nowhere near as the most embarrassing time I got dunked on. But I could box him out and stuff. That's what I'm saying, is like you could tell he wasn't going to like go into the NBA and stuff because like he'd be able to score on me very easily because he's 7 feet tall. But I could handle him down low, like I could push him off the block and stuff.
Was he like a gentle guy?
Yeah, he was Slenderman. Like he didn't have any meat on his bones, and he didn't know he hadn't grown to his body.
Okay, hey, here's a topic. Is it better to be tall or is it better to be muscular in disc golf?
In like disc golf, tall.
Or like tall.
100% tall.
Because you've got really tall disc golfers that are really good, and you've got really built
disc
golfers.
It's more lanky.
That are
really it's not necessarily
really
the height.
Built,
it's good to be
that's
lanky.
That's not tall. That's...
Huh? Like Ezra. He's not that tall, is he?
Yeah, he is. He's like
6 foot?
He's 6'3".
Oh. He's taller than I thought.
Also, you
Muscles and disc golf. yeah.
Or like Drew Gibson. Drew Gibson's like bigger. He's not built.
Well, I think in general, if you just take if you took a really muscular person and introduced them to disc golf post-muscle, they're going to have a lot harder time throwing because – in general, muscles are going to make you slower, but if you take a disc golfer and build them muscle around disc golf, like Ezra built his muscle while playing disc golf, then it aids him. But I don't think his muscle is the reason he plays so good.
I also don't know if Silas knows what a muscular person looks like.
Ezra's a muscular person. No way around that. Drew Gibson, no offense to Drew, I would not call him a muscular person.
I don't even know if I would call Ezra muscular. Like, I would consider...
Oh, come on.
Hear me out. I would consider Ezra very lean and in shape.
Yes.
But, like, to me, like, if you're saying muscular, to me, that's like an outside linebacker in football.
You're thinking like a power lifter, muscular.
Like, the reason why Ezra looks muscular is because of the people he's up against.
Well, no.
Ezra does not lift to try to be big. Ezra lifts to be in shape and to be powerful and to be strong and fast.
If but Ezra he's still muscular.
Huh?
He's still muscular, though. Like, he's still big. He's not big in comparison to, like, big weightlifters, but in comparison to your average person, he's big.
Yes, but to your average athlete, he's not. Like, he is, because I think if Ezra did do that, like, he could totally, if Ezra wanted to, he could totally lift weights to, like, compete in bodybuilding competitions, right? Like, if he wanted to, he could totally do that. But I don't think, and I think he knows this, like, getting big, like, getting a huge chest, getting massive back, getting massive legs, like, I don't think that's actually beneficial in disc golf. If anything, that's going to, like, decrease your flexibility, which is what you kind of need, that range of motion. So, like, when you were talking about muscular, I think, again, I think it's all comparative. Like, Ezra is a muscular person in disc golf. Ezra would not be a muscular person in other sports. Same thing as I'm a tall person in disc golf. I would not be a tall person in basketball. Does that make sense, kind of thing? But so, like, taking Silas's point, to me, muscular, I'm now thinking, like, okay, a linebacker playing disc golf, like a 6 foot, 230 pound linebacker playing disc golf, or like a Chet Hogren in basketball, where like, what is he, like 7-something? 7-2?
I mean, yeah. But you got to pick someone, like, at least coordinated.
Oh, okay. So, like,
I hate Chet. I hate that guy.
Maybe. He is coordinated. That guy can get up and down the court. So maybe,
I just can't stand him.
Maybe like a 6'6", like, volleyball player, where they're not super bulky, but I guess that's,
they got a lot of snap.
Yeah. I'm taking the 6'6" guy over, like, the power lifter, probably.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
But that would be a great video, honestly. I would love to see that.
It would be.
Power lifter first. I'm trying to think of, like, another, like, lean sport where, like, everyone's... high jump. There you go.
You need hand-eye coordination.
Power lifters don't have hand-eye...
Well, I was thinking linebacker.
Okay, that's why I said powerlifter. So you go powerlifter, high jump. Both which don't do anything with hand-eye coordination. That would be really cool to see. Now, I did play... go ahead.
The high jumper is definitely winning because, like, a lot of disc golf power comes from your legs. And, like, they'd be lean and they'd have really fast leg muscles.
So you, like, think the high jumper is throwing further than the powerlifter, no doubt. We're not talking.
Are we saying just, like, straight up first time on the course, just chuck a disc? Or are we saying you have, like, a month to throw and learn your disc?
Yeah, because I think what we're doing here is we can't be doing, like, playing disc golf, because one might just be much better.
Just like, who's throwing farther?
Who's throwing further? So I think it's almost like we give them a quick, like, 10-minute tutorial of, like, how to throw. Let them be athletes and, like, practice it for, like, 30 minutes. And then, boom, distance contest.
Yeah, I think the long jumper, high jumper, whatever,
is winning.
Yeah, I think so.
That'd be a great video, though.
That would be a great video. All right, well, I think that about wraps it up. That's debate night. Hopefully you all enjoyed. Thank you all so much for tuning in. We'll be back same time, same place next week after the final official Pro Tour event of the year. Start getting ready for the World Championships. It's crazy that it's already about that time. If you want to Worlds, we're going to have our companion stream going on during the final round. We did it last year. Obviously, it was electric. It'll be on our main channel if you want to catch that. We'll have a lot of stuff on the line. We'll keep talking about it as we get closer and closer, but it's a fun thing to have pulled up while you're watching the live coverage. And believe that's it. We'll talk to you all next week.